Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Amy, and I am an alcoholic.
Hello, Amy.
For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity
to accept the things that I cannot change,
the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. They are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing step one. Please welcome our panel, Shannon S. and Keith G. I will read the first paragraph on page XXVI, and then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent. In fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Shannon.
Hi, I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic. First, I'd just like to say thank you for being asked to speak here. That's pretty cool. It's always kind of crazy to me to think that anybody wants to hear me talk more than I already do. But that being said, I actually do love this part. It was very hard for me to grasp at the beginning that there might be something actually really wrong with my body too, because the mental stuff I always thought it was pretty funny. Like, it's true to a considerable extent, for me anyway, that I was full flight from reality, or at least wanted to be 100% of the time. So it wasn't until somebody introduced the idea to me of, you know, try to drink and then stop abruptly. And that really was the thing that made sense to me once I realized that I can't do that. That's why every time I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to drink this much and then I'm going to stop. And I would wind up, you know, waking up the next morning with no idea what happened, because I have no control over alcohol once I put it in my body. And that was something that I really didn't understand until I came to AA. So I thought it was just my brain. I thought I was just crazy. Which is definitely fun to find out that I'm an alcoholic and I'm crazy. But you know, it changed everything for me to just hang on to the very simple idea of, you know, alcohol cannot run my life if I don't put it in my body. And, you know, once I stopped drinking, I had to address, you know, everything else that was an issue, and I did that through the steps. But that took me a long time to figure out. All I knew at the beginning was I wasn't putting alcohol in my body, and I felt like I was losing my mind. So, you know, to see that there are two parts to this, that it's mental and it's physical, it just gave me a little bit of peace, a little bit of comfort, knowing that I can at least handle the one part. If I can just handle the one part, I can try to handle the other part. So it was just a matter of stopping long enough for somebody to tell me how to not start again that really made all the difference for me. Thanks.
Thanks, Shannon.
My name's Keith Collette, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't think it really matters whether or not I agree with the fact that I'm full flight from reality or an outright mental defect. It's true. And it didn't satisfy me, but it was absolutely true. The fact that, you know, knowing what the problem was and yet not being able to do anything about it was something that drove me insane. You know, I don't like anybody in this room as much as I like my mom. Hopefully you don't take that offensive. I'm sure feeling's mutual. You know, I swore up and down that I wouldn't take another drink because of the things that I had done while drinking to that woman. And I meant every word of it with every fiber of my soul. I was devastated what I had done to her, you know, the weekend before. And waking up with that, you know, with that woman and my brother and my sister looking at me in complete disgust and shame, you feel that. You feel that unless you're a sociopath, and you know, I'm not a sociopath. I've taken many studies and tests from different agencies, and it says that I'm not. So I think Dave disagrees with me, but or maybe he saw the results. I don't know, but. I'm simply an alcoholic, and I don't have the ability to say no and stay that way. I don't have a choice in the matter of drinking. It's removed from me, because given the choice, I probably wouldn't have many, many, many times. I would have learned my lesson, but yet I sought the same thing again and again and again. As soon as the heat was down, or I felt like it was down, usually it was like a day or two later, it seemed like it was, okay, I'm all right, free and clear. You know, and the punishment just started, but I'm thinking, okay, I'm good. Because they looked at me, I would start to drink again. And the same results. When I wasn't drinking, I was always obsessing with the idea of getting some of it in me. And not to get tore up drunk. I like to, you know, hammer that home. I didn't want to go out and get tore up and hammered and do keg stands. You know, I wanted what the alcohol did to me and for me. I wanted what it said in the doctor's opinion, where it gave me the ease and comfort, where it unleashed, you know, that tension that's inside my chest, you know, and have the ability to be able to breathe and have my mind just kind of just relax. That's what alcohol did to me and for me in the very beginning and at the end stopped doing. I would obsess because when I wasn't drinking, I was constantly under, you know, tension. Constantly felt like I had the, you know, the thumb of life right on top of me and pressing hard. And that's kind of funny when you look at it. I'm just 15 years old. Really, and my family is a decent family. We don't have no significant emotional events going on in our lives except for me. And yet to have that kind of tension, you know, I didn't know where it had came from. I don't know why it was there. In studying this chapter, I understood that people like me have this. And I seek alcohol as a solution. And when I get that solution, all of a sudden I can't safely stop or leave it alone or moderate or anything else. All of a sudden I am doing kickstands. All of a sudden I am waking up with weird people in weird situations and in places where I never imagined myself going. Or saying to people I would never do this or I would never go there. And I am there, you know. And the loudest one in that bunch, you know. It's very bizarre. I don't know if anybody else caught it when we read, when it said the physician's theory or the doctor's theory. It's not a fact, it's a theory that we have an allergy. You know, and I've looked up what an allergy is. You know, I looked up, you know, it doesn't make me better. I just wanted to know why all of a sudden we're calling it an allergy when, you know, I get a bee sting and I don't want more of it as soon as I get one. But what it is that I have an abnormal reaction. I have an abnormal reaction to what happens when it gets ingested into my body. That's different than my brother or my sister or my cousins. You know, they're able to stop, moderate, have a beer or two after work and just relax and that's it. Just never was my case. So that's all I got for right now.
Thanks. The next reading is XXVIII. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
I'm actually kind of amused at the moment, just because it's really been so long since I've read the doctor's opinion, and that's embarrassing to admit, but it really has been a while. And I remember the first time ever reading that paragraph, well, the first time ever even going through the doctor's opinion with a sponsor who just so happens to have married this guy. But the first time even going through it, it was very funny because I was like, well, can't I just read it? Like, I already read it. Like, why do we have to read it? She's like, you don't even know what it says. And I'm thinking, like, I'm not an idiot. I can read. Like, I know what it says. And I really didn't know what it said because going through it and having so many things pointed out to me that I had just skipped over turned out to be some of the most important things. And especially the line, you know, talking about the phenomenon of craving, and then it goes on to say these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and I stopped dead in my tracks. I was like, wait, what? Because that was terrifying to me. You know, when it talks about all those problems that become astonishingly difficult to solve, you know, I had all those. I had a lot of problems, and they seemed astonishingly difficult to solve. So considering I considered alcohol my solution to those problems, or at least, you know, a quick fix for the way I felt because of these problems, I was horrified because they were, like, pretty much just taking away the one thing that was even decent about the situation. And I heard people say at meetings constantly, like, well, alcohol stopped working for me. And I didn't understand what that meant for a really long time, because I was thinking to myself, like, well, it still works for me. I still get pretty wasted. Like, I don't know how high your tolerance has to be for alcohol to just not work for you anymore. But it turns out what people were talking about was the fact that, you know, I could drink and I wouldn't get the effect that I used to get. And the effect, they didn't mean getting drunk, they meant getting relief, you know, getting ease and getting comfort. So I had to go to meetings for, you know, a whole year and drink constantly throughout that time before I figured out that I can't really figure this stuff out on my own and that I'm going to need a little help because I'm an alcoholic, because I have the phenomenon of craving. I'm never going to be able to just, on my own willpower, pick up a drink and put it back down. You know, I just moved into Christopher Newport University a couple months ago, and it's terrifying, honestly. A college campus is like a playground for an alcoholic, I swear to God. Like, tailgates, I went to a tailgate for 10 minutes, and then I went back to my room because I was like, oh no, I don't belong here. And, you know, it's just funny to see, you know, I see other people doing these things that I can't do simply because I react differently. And for so long, I thought it was something about my character. I thought it was something about me, you know, something so horribly wrong with me that I need to be ashamed about, that I need to hide from everybody. Because I thought I was just a bad person, you know, and I didn't even know the phenomenon of craving was a thing. You know, so the way I saw it was, oh, I intend on not getting that drunk, but I get that drunk because I suck. And that was like as far as my logic took me pretty much any time I thought about it. And, you know, I had all these different reasons for drinking, or so I thought anyway. You know, I'd say, you know, I drink because I'm depressed. I drink because I am anxious. You know, I drink because something good happened, or something bad happened, or something exciting happened, or absolutely nothing was happening, so I was bored and I needed something to do, so I drank. And true as those things may have been at the time, you know, point blank, I drink because I'm an alcoholic. And when I start drinking, I can't stop because I'm an alcoholic. And as simple as these ideas seem, they were so difficult for me to grasp in the beginning, just because I didn't even know up from down yet. And I was still drinking when I was going to meetings. So I really just wanted everybody around me to think that I was sober so I would never actually have to get sober, because that one line about never safely using alcohol in any form was the thing that made me realize, like, if I do this, I have to really do this. I can't do the steps and fix my life and still drink. And that was horrifying to me, because all I'd ever done about anything was drink. So thanks.
Awesome. You know, I like what it clearly states that the phenomenon of craving is limited to the class of drinkers that they're talking about. That it's not, you know, indigenous to anybody else other than me. My brother doesn't have it. You know, when he drinks, you know, he gets as much as he wants when he wants, and that's it. And when I drink, I never get enough. I can never say when I'm going to stop drinking with certainty. You know, and 9 times out of 10, it's going to be when they run out of alcohol somewhere, when it stopped being served. I run out of money and people to screw over to get some more. You know, that's when I usually stop and wake up sober. Or I've passed out flat on my face, drunk. So it's limited. And these allergic type can never use it in any form at all. You know, I hear debates all the time, and I don't really get into them. I just listen to them, and they're pretty neat to listen to. You know, people are like, well, you can't use it in cooking, and you can't use it in mouthwash, and you can't, you know, put cologne on because, you know, it's going to trigger something off. I mean, if that works and that's for you, then that's fantastic. You know, if that's what that means for you, that's wonderful. Then don't. I don't like any of that kind of stuff in any of my food. Never have, never. It's not the purpose of me eating either, is to get drunk. I'm like, I hope this duck has some delicious bourbon on it, never crosses my mind. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm going up for 20 helpings of the same bourbon chicken. You know, it's not going to, you know, but that's me. And I'm not making a joke for you if it's, you know, very sensitive for you. I had an uncle in the 80s that was on antabuse, and I thought it was funny. You know, but I got a warped sense of humor. You know, he'd put on a bunch of cologne and he'd break out and he'd start burning up and it'd freak him out. And, he couldn't use alcohol in any form because of medication. You know, but putting on cologne didn't make him break out in the phenomenon of craving. You know, and I think what they were talking to when it came to me was is that if I try to ingest any kind of alcohol for the intent or the purpose of drinking alcohol, for ease and comfort, recreation, see what it tastes like, then I'm just wrong, and then I can't use it. Then it's probably going to break out into some phenomenon of craving. I'm not going to be able to stop for that purpose. So that's my take on that.
We are still on XXVIII. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
I've met some people, I think it's funny, who get sober and all of a sudden they like really hate alcohol. I get it, I do. Like, I hate what alcohol, I don't even hate what alcohol did to me, because I mean, it got me here, you know, it's that whole thing. But I don't really have anything against alcohol, because like I said, you know, it's harmless to me unless I put it in my system. And I mean, there's situations I shouldn't go in. Anyway, my point here is that first sentence is so true. I love the effects produced by alcohol. I don't just love it, like, I lived for it. I really did. I didn't want to live without the effect produced by alcohol. I didn't know how to live without the effects produced by alcohol. And that part of, you know, my alcoholic life seeming like a normal one was really true, you know, until I really saw for myself that other people did not drink like me. And even if they did, their consequences were far different than mine. I couldn't seem to keep my life together when I was drinking. Just bad things were always happening to me when I was drinking, and I could not for the life of me understand why. I just thought I was maybe unlucky for a while. And, you know, I did all of my drinking in high school. You know, three years is really all it took for me to run it right into the ground. So kind of used up my lifetime supply pretty quick there. But, you know, I really didn't see what I was doing as an issue for a long time. You know, I remember I grew up in the same neighborhood as this kid. We rode the same bus from first grade all the way until 12th grade. And I remember once I was riding the school bus and, you know, I had rum in an apple juice bottle. And that wasn't anything unusual for me because I drank at school all the time. I pretty much just drank all the time. And, you know, I remember I opened it, I took a sip, and I guess he smelled it, because he was like, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "Yeah, what are you talking about?" He was like, "You're drinking, and it's like 6:45 a.m. And I was like, "Okay." everybody does what they need to do to get through the day. And I said those exact words to him, and I believed them wholeheartedly. You know, I had this warped idea that everybody's got their thing, you know? You've got the kids who you sneak out at lunch to smoke a cigarette, which I also did. And then you had the kids who, you know, would smoke a ton of pot all day long as soon as they got home from school, which I usually also did. And then there were just all these things that I thought people did. You know, some people have their clubs, and some people have their academics, and some people are in the honor society, and some people drink, and I drink, so oh well. And, you know, I remember being in treatment, and they told me that one of my goals was to admit that I was an alcoholic. And I thought that was easy as anything, because in my mind it was, okay, alcoholic, what do? They drink. Means addicted to alcohol, can't stop drinking, I can't stop drinking, I'm an alcoholic, boom, like checking the box, let's get me out of here. And unfortunately, you know, it wasn't explained exactly the same way as it was explained in AA. I was in a treatment center for minors, it didn't center on drugs and alcohol. So when I got to AA, I hear this totally different idea of an alcoholic. And it's like, oh, well, you'll do anything for a drink, you're selfish, you have a big ego. I do, I should stop saying you. And it's like, you know, I have a big ego. I'm self-centered, I'll do pretty much anything to get what I want. I'm manipulative, I lie. And I was like, oh, I don't like that definition as much. And, you know, and then it went on to tell me that I have to find a spiritual solution. And I was like, what is this? And I wasn't into it, you know? Like, I didn't feel like it was something I really wanted to do. But that ease and comfort was the key for me. You know, that's why I drink, because I'm restless, I'm irritable, and I'm discontent. Always. And I need something to fix it. So it was kind of wild to me when, you know, people were telling me, you're gonna have to get that from the program. Because I read the steps on the wall a million times, and I was like, those don't sound comforting. You know, it sounded probably exactly the opposite, because it was like, how about you tell everybody every horrible thing you've ever done and then go apologize and then pray a lot? And I was like, yikes, like it just didn't sound like something I wanted to do. But you know, the only reason that I can make it through a day now without drinking is because I get my ease and comfort from the program. I get my ease and comfort from the fellowship. I get my ease and comfort from carrying the message, from doing stuff like this, from praying. I meditated the other day. It was bizarre. I never do it. And I set a timer for 10 minutes, and then I just sat on my bed and tried to think about nothing. And I made it through 6 of the 10 minutes until I was like, this is ridiculous. But that was 6 minutes that I wasn't spending doing something for me. That was 6 minutes that I spent doing something, putting effort into, you know, a relationship with a higher power that I was told will give me the same ease and comfort as alcohol. But I had to do it before I understood that, you know, so I always wanted the opposite way. Like, I wanted to not want to drink before I would stop drinking. Like, I figured if one day I woke up and I was like, hey, I don't want to drink, I was like, all right, I'll be sober. Like, that'll be perfect. But I had to stop drinking to get to the point where I wanted to actually be sober. And, you know, I wanted the steps to do the same thing. I wanted the ease and comfort before I actually took any action. But, you know, there's a phrase that I've heard a couple of times, and I think there was a speaker up in Syracuse who talked about it, where he said, you know, it doesn't work if you read it, and it doesn't work if you think it, or work if you know it, it works if you work it. And that was just such a foreign concept to me at the time. I was horrified. I thought my life was going to suck forever and ever, as long as I wasn't drinking. And I was wrong, because that ease and comfort does come from this program. And, you know, if I'm sitting up here saying that, like, Keith knew me day one, so he knows that it worked for me. But a lot of people in here didn't know me at day one. And, I was a train wreck. I'm still kind of a train wreck, but I'm like a sober, better train wreck. But you know, that ease and comfort that gets talked about, it's like at least I've experienced it, you know? I don't experience it 24/7, but I don't get it from alcohol today. And I didn't really get it from alcohol at the end either, but I don't really know what point I made there. But over to you, Keith.
Thanks, Shannon. You know, I have had the privilege of seeing a lot of people get sober. You know, some in this room and a lot of other rooms. You know, I have been sober since Shannon got sober, 17 years old. You know, and I'm obviously not, you know, 17 anymore. And I know it shocks you to think that I'm 47. I think you thought I was a lot younger, but just kidding, I'm not. You know, that's 30 years. I've watched a lot of people get sober, and that's 30 years of reflecting. You know, and this program is all about reflecting about what I used to be like. You know, what happened and what I'm like now, and what I'm like now again, and what I'm like now, and then perfecting it and learning more about it. And you know, somebody had said, you know, a long time ago, the longer I stay sober, the better my childhood is. and it's amazing how true that is. I talked to people that knew me when I was getting drunk from 13 to 17 years old, and to hear their perspective is way different than mine. I think we are extremely, and it's good that we're extremely hard on ourselves and very easy on other people, and I think that's the way it should be. I think a lot of times I judged myself by my intentions, and the world seen my actions, and my intentions were what devastated me, along with the actions too. I mean, the actions were troublesome, but I lived in intentions. That's where I lived. That was my reality, was my intentions. I think this is probably, when I was brand new, by and large, my favorite paragraph in the Big Book. By far, the greatest, you know, paragraph I ever read. When somebody introduced this, that men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. No kidding, you know. I mean, if I grew a third arm out the middle of my chest by drinking a few drinks, I probably wouldn't keep drinking. You know, that wouldn't be the effect that I was looking for. It didn't categorize this, you know, and study it all you want to. You know, call my bluff. But it doesn't say alcoholic men and women drink essentially because they like it. It says men and women. And why is it different? You know, I mean, everything else is talking about alcoholics. You know, but this doctor, you know, head of this psych department, leading authority on drug and alcohol addiction, says men and women. He could have said a lot of things. Because my brother drank because he liked the effects produced by alcohol. You know, my sister drinks because she liked the effects produced by alcohol. My 17-year-old daughter's had a few drinks at a time or two, and I guarantee she liked the effects produced. It's the reason, you know, why I drank to begin with, because I liked that effect. I liked what it did to me. It gave me, you know, I used to joke about it all the time, but it gave me the Jimmy Crack corns, and I don't give a, you know, about nothing. When a few got in me, oh my God, it made good times better, bad times good, and in no times it made something happen. And I like that effect. It was electric. It was a magic, you know. It was, you know, people that warned me. You know, I was the only drinker in my family. Only drinker when I started drinking. My mom never drank. My dad, my grandparents. I know it's odd, you know, an Irish Catholic and a Polish Catholics, you know, they didn't drink. But, you know, they used to tell me the good ones don't, Keith. The ones that study and follow directions, they don't. They don't do what you do. And I looked at him like, you guys are foolish. Do you not know what's trapped inside this magical bottle? You know, what it does? It makes a skinny little 13-year-old boy that's terrified of the world rip his clothes off in front of God and everybody and run through the trailer park and run through the fires and swim naked with the, you know, grown-ups and kiss somebody that didn't ask to be kissed. You know, the first time he drank, that's exactly what happened. And I'm like, you know, is it really that bad? I mean, really, I just had the time of my life. It was better than the inventions of MTV at the time. Showing my age is in the 80s. man, no amount of therapy, no amount of church that I had been to, no amount of family reunions or joyous occasions had ever given me that sensation. That sensation that was so elusive that I didn't know that I would do anything under the sun to get it again. I heard a friend of mine talk about it the other day. He said, you know, Keith, we're not liars. You know, I hear people talk about it all the time in AA. I've spoken it and I've parroted it for years. Yeah, I'm a liar, cheating, a thief, you know. No, I'm not. Read the book. Those are things that I used, but I also used being kind and decent and generous and polite as well. But you'll never hear a speaker up there saying, I was so polite, kind, decent, drunk. You know, because I'm drawn to being negative. I'm drawn to being the dark side. You know, if it took, you know, being honest to get what I needed and wanted, I'd be up here saying I was telling the truth every step of the way to get what I wanted. But sometimes I needed to lie. Sometimes I needed to cheat. Sometimes I needed to bully up. Sometimes I needed to be generous and giving and, you know, polite about things. I'd mix it up a little bit to get it, you know, whatever it took, you know, whatever it took, whatever it demanded me to be, that's what I became, you know, that's what I became. Up until drinking alcohol, I never stole a thing in my entire life. And even after drinking for a while, I never stole. But eventually, things got in the way of me getting what I wanted, what I needed, and what this alcohol demanded of me. And I walked into a place like 7-Eleven, and I stuffed a case of beer under my arm. And I knew there was one guy working the register. He ain't gonna chase me. You know why? Because he's got a line of people. And I just walked out the door. And he said, hey. I'm like, see you later, buddy. You know, I stole my first case of beer at 14 years old. I wasn't a thief. You know, I was a kid that had something demanding something of him and from him. I was willing to sacrifice. I was willing to do whatever it took to get some more of it. I used to think that I was drinking because times were tough, you know. And if you had the life that I had, and I just described it, I had a decent life. I lived in Pleasantville, a place called Brighton, Michigan. Some people might have never heard it. You know, it's between Ann Arbor, Detroit, Lansing, and Flint. It's right in the middle. It's where all the wealthy car dealer people live at, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. Their kids all went there, and it was a great community to live with or live in. There was one thief in the town, you know, and it became zero when I sobered up. And it was a wonderful place. It was a wonderful place. Crime went down 50% when I sobered up. I swear to God. It's not podium talk. It's a fact, you know. So I used to think that, man, my lot in life, you know, I grew up without a father, but yet I had uncles and cousins and you know, mentors all around me to give me the same, you know, love and affection and attention and discipline and whatever I needed, and I got. I never went without. I never knew I was as poor as I was, but yet I drank for the excuse, well, oh, God, it's so tough. I thought that's why I was drinking. I thought it was because my girlfriend was, you know, holding out or whatever. You know, it wasn't. I drank whether she did or she didn't. I drank whether I had a good lot in life or I had a bad lot in life. Whether I had a big chubby girlfriend or a skinny anorexic one. It really didn't matter what was going on. I drank no matter what. You know, it says the alcoholic life is the only normal one. I thought everybody was like me. Because on my way down, you know, the pipe, I end up with people like me. I was told early on, you attract your own kind. You know, water seeks its own whatever, you know, mercury, whatever. You know, I attracted my own kind of people. If you act good, you'll be around good people. If you act bad, you'll be sucked into the bad people. And the people that I was drinking with were drinking just like me. So I never questioned that the alcoholic life is the only normal one. Absolutely. I used to see people like you getting caught driving drunk, you old people, and having to get your court card signed. And I remember being at parties and say, hey, we got a guy that just got back from Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He needs some signature. I'm like, what does that even mean? It just means he needs some signatures. I'm like, absolutely. Give me a beer and give me the pen. And I'm signing people. I don't even know what I'm signing. I attracted my own kind of people. When I wasn't drinking, this is the condition that I find myself in. Restless, irritable, and discontented. You know, at 17, I'm like, what does that even mean? I don't even know what those words mean. I'm a dropout from 8th or 10th grade, you know, so I don't know what restlessness is. And my sponsor told me, it's you. You can't sit still. You're up, you're down, you're having to go to the bathroom 13 times in 1 hour. He asked me a question. You ever traveled across the country in an airplane? I'm like, absolutely. I went to San Diego. I played soccer, blah, blah, blah. He goes, how long was the flight? I'm like, I don't even know, like a million hours? He goes, how many times you go to the bathroom? I'm like, didn't. He goes, it's amazing. You could travel across the country and not go to the bathroom, but yet you can't sit 1 second in an AA meeting without getting up, down, having to leave all the time. Do you really got that much in your bladder? And he was right. He was absolutely, I couldn't sit still. I didn't want to be where I'm at. I didn't know where I wanted to go, but I didn't want to be where I was at. And I had to get up and I had to leave and somebody said, where are you going? I'm like, I have no idea. I'll let you know when I get there. And I would get there and I didn't want to be there either. And I'm like, this sucks. You know, that's what restlessness. Irritability. Absolutely know about that. You know, walked into Myers Thrifty Acres up in Michigan. It's like Walmart before there was. And they had greeters there. And the guy would hand you a shopping cart and a bag and list the coupons and said, welcome to Myers. I'm like, thank you. Goes, how may I help you? You can mind your own business. That's how you can help me now that we've gotten personal about this stuff. All of a sudden, I'm set off and I don't want to be there. And I'm pissed that you're asking me questions. You know, I'm 17 going back to high school and everybody's asking me, how are you doing, Keith? I'm like, none of your business. That's how I'm doing. Well, are we writing a book? You know, leave me the hell alone. I don't know how I'm doing. I'm irritated all of a sudden, and I don't know why I'm irritated. And I'm discontented is that the world could show up at my doorstep, all but one, and say, Keith, we love you, and you're the greatest human being. And I'm wondering what that one person's doing and why they didn't show up. Because I'm not satisfied by the thousands and the hundreds of thousands. I'm concerned with the ones that didn't. You know, I'm discontented. I'm not satisfied with anything. My sponsor said, you ever feel like that drinking? I'm like, absolutely not. It never crossed my mind. I was fine wherever I was at. Don't like me. Don't say hi. Ask me the questions you want to ask me. You know, I will go to a place where I don't want to be, and I will stay there for hours. As long as I have Miller Genuine Draft or something similar to that, I will stay there until my ass grows roots. You know? So this applies to me when I'm sober. Unless I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort. And I'd like to tell you that that's the only thing that makes me an alcoholic. Not what I drank, how much I drank, or how long I drank. The fact that I need ease and comfort from that condition of being restless, irritable, and discontented. I can be that thing sober in AA, and I can be that way not in AA and waiting to take a drink. But the bottom line is that I need ease and comfort no matter what. And I will either get it through alcohol, which I found that I couldn't do it anymore, like Shannon was mentioning. The alcohol ceased to give me ease and comfort, but could get me drunk. And I would sit there miserable drunk. I'd be crying drunk. I'd be like, oh my God, this life sucks drunk. It's not working, but I'm tore up. I need ease and comfort. And I will find that any way I can possibly get it. I will do anything for ease and comfort. I will sacrifice friendships and family. I will sacrifice opportunity. You know, your little scary stories of what's going to happen to me if I take a drink and end up in prison and being somebody's girlfriend is not going to deter me when I'm not getting ease and comfort. And I know I need it. You know, that's what makes me an alcoholic. That's what makes me insane. is the fact that I ain't got it. You know. So I could go on and on. Like I said, this is my favorite, was my favorite all-time paragraph in the big book. And the bottom line is, all I need is a psychic change. not somebody telling me, just don't drink, Eve. Just don't drink no matter what. Because that's not what the doctor said. That's not what the people that have gone before me said. That's not what the recovered alcoholics say. They say you need a psychic change. And we will show you. We will show you how to get that, you know, through these steps, through this program. You know, we will show you how to get that psychic change. So I think we're getting ready to talk about a little bit about how we get it. That's it.
Thanks. We are continuing the reading on page XXIX. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date, favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight.
Okay, I'm kind of amused again because I know this is around the part where it talks about, you know, the guy who has a tendency to get tight at the wrong time, I think it is how it's phrased. And, you know, the guy who builds the structure just to pull it down on his head. And that was so me. That was so me. I mean, I was pretty much always drunk. But if it was the wrong time to be drunk, I was definitely drunk. Like, most times you saw me, I was probably drunk. But no, if it was really like a bad time to be drunk, I was definitely, definitely drunk. And I don't know why I thought of, well, no, I do know. I know why I thought I was so good at, like, handling everything. I thought I was such a great liar, and I took pride in these things for a long time because I spent a really long time not getting in trouble for my drinking. You know, the only thing, well, I mean, my parents pretty much wouldn't speak to me, but if you don't consider that trouble, then I really didn't get in trouble, never with the police, never at school, never anywhere else but home. You know, and there were so many wrong times to be drunk where I was drunk, and my being drunk always made those situations worse. So, you know, I know it's true when I say, like, there's never going to be a situation which a drink won't make worse. Because I could be in the worst situation in my life ever, of anybody's life, like just every bad thing you could possibly imagine could be happening, and I would drink in that situation and it would somehow get worse. I don't know how, but it would get worse. I like this speaker, Earl Hightower. He's hilarious, and he says, order me a drink and call the police. And I love that because that's kind of like how I feel. It's like, I never know what I'm gonna get. And what's it say? Yeah, the phenomenon of craving becoming paramount to everything else is absolutely applicable to the way that I behaved when I was drinking. You know, because it didn't really matter what was going on, you know? I skipped a midterm in one of the classes that I needed to graduate when I was already on thin ice. I wasn't even sure I was gonna graduate high school, by the way. So there's a midterm that I had to take that day, like no makeups without an actual official note for blah, 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 blah. And whatever, I skipped it to go get drunk because somebody offered and that was all it took. And you know, this resolve that I had to really get sober on my own went away very fast, you know, because I would tell myself after the one meeting that my parents could take me to, oh, because they didn't let me drive. This was my senior year of high school. They didn't let me drive because they said that they knew I was going to drive drunk, and they were probably right. But, so, The one meeting a week that they took me to was at the church that I grew up going to. Not only in the church, but in the room that I went to Sunday school in for like my whole childhood life. So it was just like a big slap in the face from God, in my opinion. And I was bitter about it for a long time. Now I think it's kind of funny, but I was really bitter at the time. So I was still in the mindset of rejecting everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't look anybody in the eye, didn't get phone numbers, didn't have a sponsor, didn't ask for your number, didn't do any of that. So I was just trying to do everything on my own. But that craving would come in and I couldn't handle it. It was beyond my control. And I think the concept that's interesting is losing the choice in the drink. Because I had lost the choice quickly after I started drinking. But it had never been explained to me that way. It was just a really long time of people saying, you need to stop, you need to stop, you need to stop. And me thinking that I had absolutely every reason in the world to keep drinking. You know, because everything was a wreck behind me. You know, I just had this wake of destruction, and it was because of my drinking. But drinking was the only thing that made me feel good, so that's obviously my only option, is to keep drinking. And you know, that craving, it was just something that I couldn't get over, that obsession too. You know, the mental obsession was definitely the bigger part for me. You know, because that was all it really took. When I had every reason to keep doing the right thing, and then I just get sidetracked so easily. When, you know, the whole day I've been saying, you know what, I'm not gonna drink today. I'm not gonna go ask this person for X, Y, or Z. I'm gonna, you know, put my headphones in, put my head down, go to class and go home and behave myself. You know, and then I go to lunch and the kid's sitting at the table like, you wanna skip fourth and go get wasted? And I'm like, yes. Like, no arm twisting involved. And it was always that easy because I had that craving. I had that mental obsession. I could not beat it by myself. You know, I didn't have that kind of willpower. It baffles me when I hear stories of people who are real alcoholics who say, like, no, I stayed sober without a sponsor, without working the program for, you know, this amount of years. I'm like, years? Couldn't even go weeks. I absolutely could not. I loved drinking. I loved how it made me feel. Even if I was miserable drunk and miserable sober, which I was at the end, you know, because I didn't have the choice in drinking and I didn't want to be drunk, but I kept finding myself drunk and it was driving me crazy. At least I was drunk, because I was miserable sober and I was miserable drunk. But when I was miserable drunk, I was drunk, and that was all that mattered. Still, you know, they talk about following alcohol into the gates of insanity or death, and I'm totally one of those people. Like, I'm right there at the gates, like, standing there when the gates open in the morning, because I'm there. I need it, and I need it now, immediately, and I don't know why. I don't know why. Like, I love that Keith mentioned, you know, thinking that everything's so hard and everything's so bad, and I really look at my life, and I'm like, okay, I'm in a, you know, sort of maybe upper middle class family. You know, both my parents have steady jobs. I never worry about where my next meal is coming from. I never worry about anything, pretty much. You know, I'm very well provided for. But all of a sudden, you get me thinking for about 2 minutes too long, and I have the worst life out there. You know, my parents who have been married for over 20 years, my sister who would do anything just so that I could have the best in life, like, all these different things. And sure, not everything went my way, but I kept creating these reasons to drink because I had to justify it somehow. I couldn't accept that I was an alcoholic, so I had 1,000 reasons to justify why I was still drinking. And it's why I thought everything was so terrible. It's why, you know, like, I look at the fact that I was even medicated for depression and anxiety when I was drinking, and that's ridiculous, because it's like, how was I ever gonna know if those were even like the right doses, the right medication, the right anything? I was like pouring a ridiculous amount of alcohol into me all the time. It was never gonna work the way it was supposed to. It says it right on the label, do not drink alcohol. And I didn't listen. I didn't listen to anybody. There were so many reasons to stop drinking, and it was never enough until I was so beat down, you know, until it came to the point where I actually wanted to stop because that craving was driving me insane. And it's not always the easiest thing to do to get alcohol when you're not 21. I mean, I'm still not 21, I'm 20. I'm 20. And when I stopped drinking, I was 18. So it's like, I was 18. And nobody would buy me alcohol because everyone knew that I was a train wreck. So everybody was like blackballed from buying me alcohol by my family. My sister seriously went around to all her friends like, do not buy her alcohol or I will kill you with my bare hands. And they didn't. So like all my sources were cut off and everybody was watching me all the time to see what I was doing. And I was just trying to be normal while thinking about drinking all the time. And I just wanted that to stop. I just wanted to be free of that. And you know, that was always enough in the beginning, you know, of course, you know, I started working steps and I had a sponsor and I was going through the book. And then all of a sudden I'm raising the bar. And I'm like, well, now that I don't crave it all the time, like, why don't I have a lot of money? And why don't I have a ton of friends? And why won't my parents trust me still? I've been sober for 3 months. That's absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, I kept raising the bar, but it's that craving that always comes back. You know, I remember that on hard days. You know, I could have the worst day ever now. And I'll think back to, like, my first couple of months sober. And I'm like, oh, my God, thank God I'm not like that anymore. Thank God. Early sobriety was horrible for me. Just obsessed all the time with drinking. I used to like scream in my car before I went into meetings because I was just so frustrated, just all this pent up energy and nothing to do with it. So I'd just scream and then I'd go into a meeting. Like that's a totally normal, stable thing to do. But I had to do it to get sober and it worked. So that's great. I recommend that, by the way. If you're feeling very frustrated, just scream in your car though, because if the door's open, it's awkward. But point being, you know, I have that craving, I have that obsession, and if I'm not treating it with something, it takes over me. You know, it rules my life. Even today, you know, if I go too long, I got pretty bratty this summer. I picked up a second job, so I was really busy, and I wanted my free time to be social, which was all my excuses for not going to meetings. And I turned into a monster all over again. I found myself in so many situations where I needed to apologize to people that I didn't want to be apologizing to. I was saying the most off-the-wall things, you know, just bitter and just angry and for no reason. Well, not for no reason, actually. The reason is because my sobriety was on the back burner. And, you know, this is something that I have where if I don't take care of it, I revert back to the same way I was when I got here, obsessed with finding some sort of relief. And you know, today it's just a different method of getting that relief. It's, you know, working the program, talking to alcoholics, going to meetings, praying, all that. It's bizarre because I never thought I would be the kind of person to sit in front of a room full of people and talk about how praying and meditating helped me. But yeah.
Thank you.
I talked for a long time.
I'm gonna go ahead and read the last paragraph, which is on page XXX. All these, and many others, have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. If you can do like seconds.
You got it, Keith.
Rock on.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the best that a doctor can come up with is just don't drink. And you won't have the physical obsession to drink. The phenomenon of craving will not develop if you do not take alcohol into your body. It's gone. You know. How do you get to that point? When everything in you is driving you to yet take another drink. And he said it in the beginning, a psychic change. If I have a psychic change, which this whole program is designed to do, is to give me a relationship with a God that will produce the psychic change, therefore I don't have to worry about taking a drink. And I don't have to worry about the phenomenon of craving developing. But I got to take these steps in order for that to happen. So grateful for y'all having me and I don't know if Shannon's grateful for it, but I am. I'm sure she is.
I am.
For allowing us to come up here and share just a little bit about what we do. And Dave, it's great to see you and many others. Thanks.
Okay. The seventh tradition, we're going to pass the baskets. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. Announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements? Jason.
Hey everybody, I'm Jason. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Jason.
This Wednesday, October 25th, there's an eating meeting at the Great Bridge Step Study Group, which is at St. John's Episcopal Church. Laura L. from Richmond is coming to share and eat at 6 and speak at 7.
Thank you. Any other announcements? Not Victoria? No.
Saturday, November 24th, District 23 is hosting a gratitude breakfast. It's a fellowship, speakers, food. The address is 1400 Buell Road in Virginia Beach. That's Bayside Presbyterian Church.
Thanks, Malcolm. Victoria?
I'm sorry, I'm an alcoholic. October 28th from 11:35, I believe. Busy Paw is holding an event called Fall Back. It's going to be a 5K walk slash run with trivia. There's going to be a carnival game, dressed up in costume. Yeah, the Beaver Dam Park up in Gloucester.
Thank you. Anybody else? Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you.
I'm Patrick Alcoholic.
Hey, Patrick.
Patrick.
Welcome. Sponsorship. Oh, literature. Literature is available. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting if you would like to purchase a book. Everything else is free. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to me. Reminders. Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. Closing, in closing, let's thank our panel again. Thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol. Who has volunteered to read the paragraphs? Great.
Hey everyone, my name is Travis. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Travis.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thanks for reading.
All right, we have a nice way of closing. Our Father.
Our Father,
who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come,
thy will be done,
on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation,
but deliver us from evil.
For thine is the kingdom,
the power and the glory,
forever and ever.
Amen.